Thanks for joining us for another Family Life Today program brought to you Monday to Friday by Power to Change. I'm sure you'll hear something today that could give you a fresh perspective on your marriage or family situation. Be encouraged as we join Dave and Anne Wilson.
So we've got Sean McDowell sitting across us in the studio. What are you thinking?
I love it when he's here. I feel like we have great conversation. There's something too about legacy. When I see Sean, I think of Josh, his dad. And here's what I'm thinking about you.
Me?
Yes, you, because I think Josh's work, More Than a Carpenter, the book that he wrote, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, were pivotal in your walk and journey with God.
I came to Christ my junior year in college, so it was late. Ann and I started dating, get married 2 years later. So I'm still pretty new as a believer. Okay. We come on staff with Athletes in Action, a branch of Crew. They send us to the University of Nebraska to be a chaplain for the sports teams there.
So we're both working with all the collegiate athletes at the University of Nebraska.
Yeah, okay. And I don't think it was 3 months where I wake up one day and said...
He drops the biggest bomb.
You can tell.
The biggest bomb. I walk in, I had just met with some woman on an appointment, some athlete, and he's sitting in the living room. He has his Bible on his lap. He goes, I don't even know if any of this is true.
Oh my goodness.
I said, what? He goes, all of it. Bible, Jesus.
Resurrection.
How do we know it's true? And I was like, we've devoted our lives to telling people about this, and now you're doubting it?
Well, here's the good part of that story. She looked at me pretty shocked, and she said this. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, I know you need to find out. Go find out. Find out if this is true. She had no doubts about it. But she didn't say, you're crazy. She just said, do the homework. Well, guess what? I picked up Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I picked up the book we're going to talk about today that you've revised and redone, and you're now part of this with your dad, More Than a Carpenter. Those were two critical resources that helped me. Literally, you know, I think I read every outline point in evidence.
Well, he's taught a class at the Institute of Biblical Studies, IBS, at Crew, that we took that class.
Yeah.
Dave was so excited, and Evidence That Demands a Verdict, it is a textbook, man.
Yeah.
And I was depressed, like, are you kidding me? Like, we're going to have to go. But what it did is it gave us confidence of how to share the gospel. Of we're like building our lives and foundation on these principles and truths from scripture.
And I guess you've heard stories like that many times.
Oh, so I have. Almost everywhere I go and I speak at a church or a conference, somebody will talk about either More Than a Carpenter or Evidence, one of two things. Either helped solidify my faith during a period of doubt, like you said, or it was a tool that God used to draw him to the kingdom in the first place.
Did you have any of the same kind of struggle?
I went through a period of doubt, and this was probably mid-90s when I was freshman or sophomore in college. And it was the first time we had this new invention called the internet. But I was just searching around. I don't remember what I was searching for, but came across like the skeptical atheist web. And a lot of it was built on at that time, because Evidence was one of the only apologetic resources going back then. Chapter by chapter, doctors, historians, lawyers responding to it. And this is just the first time I had really come across smart, intelligent, educated people who had good reasons why they weren't Christians. And it's like time froze. And it was really the first time I thought, I could be wrong about this. Had a conversation with my dad, and same thing, kind of similar to your response. He didn't freak out. He's like, I love you, and you got to find out what's true. And, you know, just stayed calm. And that's exactly what I needed to hear. So some of the backbone of the work I've done with my dad comes from my own sense of going, I need to know for myself if I can bank my life on this.
Now, how much has your dad and his life and his work influenced what you're doing? I mean, you're a Christian apologist. You teach, you write, you speak. Basically in this same sort of area your dad worked in, is that a big influence on your life, obviously?
I don't even know how to calculate that, to be honest, which is fine with me because I gave up long time ago trying to compete with my dad's influence in any sense. First off, it's a losing game. But second off, none of that stuff matters. All that matters is, are you faithful to the opportunity that God has called you to? And there's just a contentment and peace that comes from seeing it that way.
Mm. What's it been like? And what's your relationship like with your dad now? Even to write with him, like, because you guys have done several books together.
You know, when I went through the questioning period, I didn't go to my dad for answers. I needed to go to other people like William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland and others. You got to hear the same thing from somebody else.
Yeah.
And he wasn't offended by that.
Oh my goodness. He was thrilled by that. That's what he would want me to do. We had some conversations, but it wasn't like I just need to read evidence. I just had to hear from somebody else. And that's also a popular level book. I needed to go back to some of the original sources and really dive in myself. But I asked my dad, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, I said, what were you really thinking when I said I had doubts? And he goes, I wasn't worried. I said, why? He said, because the depth of the relationship you and I had, I knew you were going to come full circle. In other words, he knew I wasn't reacting out of anger, wasn't trying to prove him wrong, but because of our relationship, I could really follow truth where I felt that it led. And he said to me, he goes, you know, Jesus is the truth. If you really seek after Jesus, I'm confident you'll be in the truth. So my dad's my hero. Mm. I mean, he's human like everybody else, but he's the real deal. The way he treats my mom, the way he has a grandfather, his heart and his life just gives me nothing but profound respect for him.
Mm. So talk about More Than a Carpenter. How'd this project come about and why?
So he wrote it first in 1977. I think he updated himself in the 80s, maybe again in the 90s, little tweaks. And then in 2009, we did a first update together. And then I came to him and the team maybe a year or two ago and just said, it's been 15 years. So much has changed in culture. We need to take this from, it was a little bit more of a timely book to make it a timeless classic that could outlive if we never had a chance to update it again, almost like a mere Christianity, make it a little bit more transcendent. Mm. And given that it had been 15 years, now I have my doctorate, have my own platform, it's like it was an easy yes to get him on board to updating it again.
So is it any different?
It's different in a few ways. So in the 2009 version, we added a chapter on the new atheism because everybody was talking about Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris. So the section on science, we added like the fine-tuning argument and other arguments. Well, that conversation has shifted since 15 years. So we took that chapter out and trimmed up the one on science. More of the Carpenter's always been the kind of book you could read in probably 2 to 3 hours on a plane ride from California to Dallas or something like that. We made it even shorter and tighter. Mm. So I went through the book and I thought, anytime there's a double quote where you don't need it, I'm taking it out. So I haven't done the math, but I'm guessing we trimmed it up 5 to 10% from what was already a short book. So that's one change. When you have a book like this that works so well, you don't want to tinker with too much.
Yeah.
Anytime I thought, you know what, this is a better idea, I go, you know what, it's probably not. So it's really just not the skeleton and the meat, but just like some quotes. There was a quote that was like an updated quote on psychology and the Lord, Liar, Lunatic argument. And it was like, I forget the title, like the new, you know, psychiatry manual. And I looked, I'm like, okay, this is 1978. I think we need to update this. So we updated a few of those kind of things. And there's some new arguments that have come out positively. Mm. There's a handful of objections we needed to respond to. But the one piece we added, this was in the 2009 version, is my dad frames the story with his testimony. But in 2009, added the sexual abuse that he had been through.
Mm.
So we added, just made sure his story was really kind of up to date with things that had been public and some of the research had been updated. But it's even a shorter book because I think attention spans are even less than they were.
Sean, can you give our listeners just a little taste of maybe they haven't heard your dad's story?
Sure.
Just a quick, like, whet our appetites for a little bit of the book, because I think people are going to want to pick it up.
So my dad grew up in about as broken of a background as you can imagine. My dad's dad was a town alcoholic. My dad's older sister took her own life. Mm-hmm. My dad told me not long ago, he told me, he goes, man, I get just thinking about it. He goes, I'm walking outside of the barn with my dad. And he says to me, he goes, you know what, son? You weren't even wanted.
Really?
You were a mistake. I mean, can you imagine being told that?
No.
So my dad was so embarrassed in a small town. Having this father was just shameful. Everybody knows your business. And he was sexually abused by someone on their farm. Tells his mom, nobody believes you in the 40s. Didn't believe you in the 90s, let alone the 40s, right? And so he just met some Christians who were different, had a love and a contentment about life. And he asked them what made their lives different. And they said, Jesus Christ. My dad thought it was a joke. So he had money from a painting business. He'd just been successful in everything he touches, like Midas touch, just money and sports and politics. And he set out to try to show that Christianity was false. So he traveled to Europe, to Middle East, museums, libraries, meet with professors, and ended up being surprised by the evidence. But the way he frames it, he goes, the evidence got my attention, but it was the love of God that really drew me.
No one had ever talked about it, had
Nobody.
They at that point?
I mean, you have like C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer, and my dad. Norm Geisler was starting at that time, but there was no John Warwick Montgomery. I mean, there's a handful of people. Now it's a dime a dozen. You can find it on the internet, and there's movements and conferences and master's degrees. He was really a trailblazer in this. And this book just took off for other reasons. But other than the people are like, wow, there's evidence you can actually have, and I can read it in 2 or 3 hours and share this with somebody. It just was unheard of at that time.
I mean, did he immediately start traveling and speaking about this, or was it sort of a grassroots? I mean, we got William Lane Craig, you know, debating atheists all over the internet. Was any of that happening then?
Even William Lane Craig, who did his doctorate on the resurrection, would talk about evidence that demands a verdict being one of the first times he heard it defended. Now, that's a popular defense, and Craig went and did an academic defense.
Yeah.
But even defenders like Craig, who are a decade plus younger than my dad, J.P. Moreland, Greg Kokel, Frank Beckwith, they'll attribute my dad as just saying he was a trailblazer doing it before anybody was. Mm. He still wanted to become going to politics. He had a 10-year charted out like month by month how he would become the governor of Michigan. And I have literally zero doubt that he could have pulled off. He's one of the few people I know that actually could have been president of the United States and done well at it.
Wow.
And so he was planning on going to politics, went to Wheaton College. And that's where it really started to shift some of his thinking, and then ended up going to Talbot School of Theology, not wanting to. There's a whole backstory to this, but showing up and like, I really don't want to enroll, but I feel like God is telling me to. Classes start like tomorrow or something, and like, you're in. He's like, okay. And then eventually he was recruited personally by Bill Bright.
He was. I was
going to
ask
you. Not because my dad was anything special at that point, but because Crewe was so early and Bill would go around and go to Wheaton. He'd go to these different places. And at least he was one of the people that my dad met early. And then he went on staff. And even with staff, it was years before he was able to speak.
Oh, I remember hearing stories about your dad cleaning toilets.
So this is a separate issue, but I've done hundreds, if not thousands of interviews. All-time favorite story is interviewing my father. For years, he wanted to be a speaker. And he tells the story of like Billy Graham coming to, I think it was Arrowhead, if I remember correctly. And he's like so jazzed to meet him because he wanted to be like a Billy Graham. Someone drags in like mud. Oh, I just get emotional thinking about it. And they're like, Josh, you got to clean that up. And he's like, I'm not going to do this. And then finally he had a thought of like, if I'm not willing to do this, you don't deserve any platform to reach people for the kingdom. So it took him a long time. And frankly, God picks people with certain skill sets and paths for certain seasons. To speak on the free speech platform, to debate Marxists and Muslims who tell you they're going to kill you if you come back to your country, you have to have a level of confidence bordering on hubris.
Yeah.
And my dad naturally has that. He's like, let's go. And so I think God had to sufficiently humble him. And that was a humbling moment you refer to, cleaning toilets, cleaning up dirt, and not getting to see Billy Graham. Like, there's a lot of moments like that in
his
life.
Were there years of that? I didn't recognize that that took a while.
He was on Crewe for years. He went to Canada. He was down in Latin America debating Marxists and getting thrown in prison. And I mean, it's like
he
stuff
was
you
thrown
can't make
in
up.
Prison. He was I don't even know half this stuff. Do you
really? Oh. If you just search Sean McTell, Josh McTell YouTube, he shares stories on this and they will blow you away. So he enrolled into a Marxist school because he was debating Marxists and wanted to learn firsthand. They learned he had infiltrated them and what he was doing. So they threw a 12-year-old girl in front of his car. Nothing he could do. Ran her over and then arrested him, threw him in prison.
That's awful.
Yeah. And he's like, I remember hearing people getting tortured from his prison cell. He goes, he goes, a lot of stuff you see in the movies of like prisons in Latin America. He goes, that stuff was not too inaccurate. At least this must have been, I don't know, the 60s or something like that. Early 60s, maybe.
Mm. Now, when you hear that story, you're tearing up. What are you feeling?
You know, my dad's 85 and he's retired. He's not publicly speaking anymore.
Yeah.
And so writing this book is probably...
Now we're
it's
all
one of the last public things we'll probably do together.
Mm, yeah. What a beautiful legacy.
So that also it makes me want to hear all of his stories. Mm. Are those on your YouTube channel that you interviewed him with those stories?
I did twice. And I mean, I could tell you stories that are, I mean, literally supernatural. Like,
tell us some.
Well, I'll tell you one. He's at Talbot and he was really bothered by his mom had passed away. He knew his dad had become a Christian because he led him to Christ. Mm. But his mom had died years before he was a believer. Thank you. It's been a long time since someone gave me tissue in an interview.
Notice I didn't get one.
I need it. He was walking out of the Santa Monica Pier. He was, which is not too far from Biola and Talbot. And he said, I was standing at the end praying. I just needed to know if my mom was saved or not. And somebody walked up thinking he was like maybe going to jump and commit suicide or something like that. And ends up having a conversation that, if I remember correctly, this individual knew my mom, my grandma from Michigan and was at a revival and went forward with her to accept Christ. And I mean, this must have been, I don't know, 20s or 30s.
Really?
So how we possibly knew this person at Santa Monica at that moment, like, I'm sorry, that's just clearly supernatural.
It's so crazy.
And he's the only person I know that this kind of stuff has happened consistently over and over again to his life. So that's one example. I mean, I could tell you more. I want people to go listen because it's my all-time favorite interview. But there was a time when he was speaking for crew. I don't remember where it was at. He would remember. And they were in a big outdoor college campus kind of presentation. Somebody was revving their engine and trying to distract everything and nobody could hear. And he just turned. He goes, he says something. He goes, I learned about the authority of the believer. I was like, in the name of Jesus Christ, be silent. And the engine blows up. He's like, that's where I gained confidence in the authority of the believer. Yeah. I don't even think I'd have the guts to pray that. I just wouldn't.
Did he pray it out loud?
Oh, I don't remember if he did. I think he did. And it was like, these are just the kinds of things.
I could see him doing that, couldn't
you? Like, storm, be still.
We're all teary.
I mean, I think we're teary because of the move of God.
Yeah. Amen.
In your life, in your legacy, in your dad here. I mean, we didn't know those stories.
And I think it gives us all hope that maybe our kids will question. But I love your dad's confidence in his God, in Jesus, that you'd come back. It just makes me hopeful for our legacies. It feels like the world, I think it can feel crazy for all of us. And I think more than ever, we're worried about our kids and our families and our grandkids. And I think you guys, you and your dad, your family, Sean, they give us hope that the gospel will continue and Jesus prevails.
I mean, you know, we got to wrap up, but if your dad is listening to this program and you were like, Dad, I want to say this to you, what would you say to him?
You know what? I can honestly tell you, I think I've told my dad everything that I want to communicate to
him. That's awesome.
And that's only because for the last 5 years, I think since he turned 80, every time we hang up on the phone, I always, the last words are, I love you, because I want that to be my last words to my dad. So I've thought about a lot. Are there any questions I haven't asked him that in 5 years I'll think, oh, why didn't I ask him this?
Yeah.
I feel that way about my grandpa who served in World War II. I'm like, I was such an idiot. Why didn't I ask him these questions? What on earth? I don't want to feel that way about my dad. We had a big event with JMM. I think it was maybe 2 summers ago. And I thought, what's the last thing I just need to say to my dad that I would regret not saying? And the only thing that came to mind was I said in front of his staff, I said, thanks for not ever pressuring me to go into ministry. Thanks for not ever putting any expectations on me other than just use your gifts for the kingdom, whatever they are. So I can't think of anything other than I just tell him I love him again and I'm proud of him.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, on behalf of Ann and I and hopefully thousands of listeners, thank you. He has impacted, and you are now impacting us and thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe possibly millions of people. What a what a legacy. I mean, I think I'm really sitting here. And I didn't really know your dad. I just met him a couple times. But because of his work, it reignited a faith. And here we are. 45 years in ministry, when in month two, I almost said, we just made the dumbest mistake of our lives, and here we are. And I was so thankful there was a resource for a person like me. And we're going to talk tomorrow a little bit more about More Than a Carpenter, because, I mean, it's so simple, but profound. You know, and I think our listeners need to know a little bit more about More Than a Carpenter.
To thank Dave and Ann Wilson and their team for another edition of Family Life Today. Although our programs are produced in America, the issues facing families like forgiveness, communication, and taking care of our kids transcend national borders. These issues profoundly affect relationships everywhere. In Australia, family life is known as Power to Change, and our mission is to effectively develop godly families. The kind of families that change the world one home at a time. A key part of our mission includes strengthening marriages and families all around the world. We want to do whatever we can to bring timeless truths to the challenges you face as you seek to strengthen your family and join us in changing the world. We hope you've been encouraged by what you've heard, and we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radio@powertochange.org.au. Our website is families.powertochange.org.au, where you can check out articles and many other resources on marriage and family well-being. We hope you can join us tomorrow at the same time for another Family Life Today.